Imagine stepping into a landscape where the soil is literally the consistency of talcum powder.
Oh, yeah, it's just completely unnerving.
Right. It is so fine that when it actually rains, the water doesn't even soak into the ground. It just, you know, hits that powdery surface and runs right off.
Exactly. It completely exposes you to the elements.
Yeah, you are standing in a place that strips away every single distraction. So welcome to today's deep dive, where we are taking you into a concept most of us usually picture as, I don't know, a peaceful national park.
Right. But in the ancient world, it was basically a terrifying, lethal wasteland.
Absolutely. We are exploring a fascinating set of lecture notes from Dr. Elaine Phillips on the historical geography of the wilderness. And our mission here is to completely reframe how you view this space.
Because it wasn't just a blank spot on an ancient map. It was this highly dynamic, treacherous crucible that literally forged civilizations.
It birthed world-famous poetry, too, and really defined the limits of human endurance. But I think the paradigm shift required to understand these sources is massive, right?
Yeah.
Especially for us today.
Oh, massive. Especially for a modern Western audience. When you hear wilderness, your immediate association is probably, well, timberline forests, alpine lakes, maybe a nice hiking trail in the Pacific Northwest.
Yeah, I'm thinking of bears and pine trees.
Exactly. But in the ancient Near East, the wilderness is the desert. Specifically, we're talking about the Judean and Negev deserts.
Okay, so we are looking at a hyper-arid region.
Yes. It's defined by these rolling, undulating limestone cliffs, deep ravines, and an annual rainfall that caps out at, like, between 2 and 12 inches.
2 to 12 inches, which means navigating the space isn't just a difficult hike, right? It's an exercise in sheer vulnerability. I mean, think about it. If you're walking through those limestone ridges and you take a wrong turn down a dried-out riverbed.
Which is incredibly easy to do.
Right, because every single ridge looks identical. There are zero landmarks. You can become hopelessly lost in a matter of minutes, miles away from any water source.
It's basically like being dropped into Death Valley without a GPS.
Wow, yeah. You are instantly uncomfortably aware of your own mortality.
And, you know, the theologian Walter Brueggemann actually coined a phrase for the psychological reality of this specific landscape. He calls it the experience of having nothing but lacking nothing.
Having nothing but lacking nothing. That's powerful.
It really is. The physical environment forces a state of absolute dependency. And in the ancient mind, that dependency created this profound ambiguity about the wilderness.
What kind of ambiguity? Like good and bad?
Exactly. Because it strips everything away, it was viewed as the ultimate place of testing and transition. It was completely silent, far removed from the noise of human civilization.
Which makes it the perfect place for, like, purification, a quiet place to meet the divine.
Right. But simultaneously, because it's so fundamentally hostile to human life, it was deeply feared as a realm of desolation. The sources even talk about it being a haunt for demons.
Okay, well, let's pause on that contradiction for a second, because it seems completely counterintuitive to me. The notes mention that ancient ritual in Leviticus 16, where the scapegoat, the goat for Azazel, is sent out into the wilderness.
Yeah, the Yom Kippur ritual.
Right. And it literally carries the sins of the community away from civilization and out into this wasteland. So if the wilderness is the designated dumping ground for sin and demonic forces, why on earth did Moses insist to Pharaoh that the Israelites needed to go directly into that exact same wilderness to worship?
It's such a great question. And to make sense of that, we have to look at the cultural mechanics of Egypt, because Egypt was this polytheistic superpower.
Everything was a god, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Every aspect of daily life, the river, the sun, the crops, was tied to an Egyptian deity. It created this constant, overwhelming cultural noise.
So it wasn't just a physical escape, it was a spiritual one.
You hit the nail on the head. And what's fascinating here is that leaving that environment wasn't a uniquely Israelite idea.
Hmm.
Egyptian records actually show other groups of Asiatic peoples living in Egypt doing the exact same thing.
Wait, really? Other groups went out to the desert to worship too?
Yeah. They retreated to the desert because it acted as a sort of sensory deprivation tank for the soul. You physically had to remove yourself from the cacophony of the Egyptian pantheon to find a space quiet enough to hear a different divine voice.
That makes so much sense. But what about the demon part? The Azazel thing?
Right. So regarding the scapegoat for the Azazel, the linguistics are super revealing. Azazel, in ancient thought, likely referred either to a harsh, jagged precipice or a demonic figure embodying the waste itself.
So sending the goat there wasn't just like regular exile.
No, it was intentionally returning death and rebellion to the very landscape that represented chaos. You're putting it safely away from the order of the community.
Wow. And surviving that chaos, whether you were an exile or a nomad, really came down to mastering the single most precious commodity in the ancient world, which is water.
Oh, water was absolutely everything.
Right. And this geography entirely dictated the lives of the earliest figures in these sources. The patriarchs, like Abraham and Isaac, they were operating on the margins of Canaanite city-states in the western Negev, places like Gerar and Beersheba.
Dealing with that talcum powder soil we talked about earlier.
Right, which the notes call lucis soil.
Yeah, lucis soil.
Yeah.
And its physical properties created just a brutal living environment. Because the dust is so fine, the rare winter rainstorms create lethal flash floods.
Because it can't absorb the water fast enough.
Exactly. The water just beads up and rushes through the wadis, which are those dry riverbeds, destroying everything in its path.
And then during the dry season, the wind picks up that loose powder.
It creates these massive, towering dust storms.
Mm.
In fact, the prophet Isaiah utilizes this exact atmospheric phenomenon as a terrifying metaphor. He describes invading armies coming in, quote, like whirlwinds sweeping through the Negev.
That sounds like a blinding, suffocating force.
It really was.
So living there required massive geographic intervention. You couldn't just sit around and wait for rain. You had to actively trap it. The notes describe them building these small dams and terraces within the wadis.
Yeah, just to force the flash floods to slow down and actually seep into the soil.
And beyond that, they had to dig deep wells into the riverbeds. I was thinking about this, and controlling a well in the Negev wasn't just about agricultural wealth. It's like controlling the airlock on a spaceship.
That is a perfect analogy.
Because if a hostile neighbor shuts off your well, you don't just lose money. Your entire civilization suffocates.
Which completely reframes a really bizarre historical conflict from the sources.
Oh, the Philistines filling the wells.
Yes. The Philistines, recognizing Abraham's growing power, systematically went through and filled his wells with dirt.
Which, when you read it normally, just sounds like petty vandalism.
Right, but it wasn't vandalism at all. It was a highly calculated act of psychological and physical warfare. By filling the wells with dirt, they were weaponizing the geography, intentionally rendering the land uninhabitable to force a migration.
Wow, that is ruthless.
And the pushback against this tactic eventually led to a major treaty. The name of the famous city, Beersheba, literally memorializes this struggle.
Wait, how so? Break down the name.
So Beer translates to, well, and Sheba means oath or seven. So the city's name is a permanent geographic marker of a life or death treaty over water rights.
That is incredible. And you know, that dynamic of survival scales up dramatically when the narrative moves from individual families in the dusty Negev to the birth of an entire nation.
Oh, moving into the Sinai.
Yes. The Israelites escape slavery in Egypt, but they aren't delivered into a lush paradise. They are led right into the Sinai wilderness. And the topography completely shifts here from dusty plains to sheer, jagged granite mountains.
The Sinai granite is an entirely different kind of hostel. This is where the landscape acts as a fiery crucible for millions of people.
I mean, you have a massive population of traumatized former slaves dragging their families into a barren rock formation.
And the tension in the historical record here is the juxtaposition between extreme human desperation and constant divine provision.
Right, because God is providing water from a solid rock, manna on the ground, and that famous pillar of cloud and fire to regulate the extreme desert temperatures.
They are completely sustained by miracles.
And they're also given the Sabbath, which we normally read as just a standard religious regulation. But put that into the psychological context of a people who just spent centuries as brutalized labor, working 7 days a week making mud bricks.
Oh, absolutely.
Being commanded to rest 1 day a week isn't a restriction. It's a radical assertion of their new freedom.
That's such an important point. Yet the sources outline how they constantly broke under the pressure of the environment anyway. You have the rebellion of Korah, you have lethal snake bites, you have the Amalekites attacking them.
Yeah, let's talk about the Amalekites, because here is where it gets really interesting to me. They are freed from brutal slavery, but their reward is to wander in a place where they are attacked by venomous scorpions and lethal snakes and these roving raiders. Was this just like a cosmic punishment?
Well, the Amalekite attacks highlight the sheer brutality of this ecosystem. Ancient warfare was terrible anyway, but the Amalekites utilize a specific tactic of targeting the stragglers.
That's just vicious.
It was. The attack from the rear, slaughtering the sick, the elderly, and the exhausted who just couldn't keep up with the main column. It was pure predatory survivalism.
So the Israelites are dealing with that, plus the environment.
Exactly. And the constant rebellions by the Israelites, complaining about the food, wanting to go back to Egypt, those are the predictable psychological breaks of people who still possessed a slave mentality.
Because they were accustomed to being told exactly what to do.
Right. And having their basic needs met by their oppressors, even if it was a terrible life. The wilderness was necessary to mold them into a, quote, kingdom of priests. They had to learn reliance.
So the environment forces a complete psychological rewrite. To borrow your phrase, they had to unlearn the slave mentality and learn foundational reliance.
Yes, beautifully said.
And the architecture of the tabernacle they built in this granite wasteland perfectly captures this. I love this detail in the notes. They didn't have cedar or oak to build it with. They used the local acacia tree.
The biology of the acacia is phenomenal.
It is. To survive the multi-year droughts of the Sinai, its taproots have to plunge dozens of feet into the bedrock. The notes say it grows at least twice as deep underground as the tree grows tall above ground.
That's how it survives. And because of that slow growth, the wood of the acacia is incredibly dense, heavy, and naturally resistant to insects.
Which makes it the only logical material for a portable sanctuary meant to survive decades in a hostile climate.
Exactly. It visually represented God dwelling amidst their harsh reality. There's a fascinating New Testament connection here, too.
Oh, with the Apostle John?
Yeah. Centuries later, John draws a direct linguistic line back to this exact structure. When he writes that God became flesh and dwelt among us, the literal Greek text actually says he tented among us.
Oh, wow. He tented among us.
Right. The phrasing is a deliberate callback to the deep-rooted, indestructible acacia wood of the wilderness tabernacle.
That is so cool. Now, moving on from the Sinai granite, that physical isolation in the wilderness didn't just forge a nation's identity. It eventually served as a literal fortress.
Yes, as we move into the Judean wilderness.
Right. Here, the topography shifts again. You have these massive, steep canyons cut deep into the limestone. And this geography turns the wilderness into the ultimate place of refuge, famously used by a young David fleeing the paranoia and jealousy of King Saul.
David retreats to the strongholds of En-Gedi, which translates to the Spring of the Goats.
And the limestone canyons there create extreme geographical barriers, right?
Absolutely extreme. Because the ravines are so sheer and deep, you could literally have two armies standing on opposite cliffs, well within shouting distance of each other.
Because sound carries beautifully across the open air of the wadi.
Exactly. But for one group to actually reach the other, they would have to execute this treacherous hours-long climb down the cliff face and back up the other side.
Making a surprise attack virtually impossible.
Right. It creates this bizarre acoustic intimacy paired with absolute physical separation.
And spending years trapped in these limestone fortresses, completely dependent on hidden springs, birthed some of the most enduring poetry in the world.
The Psalms.
Yes. When David writes Psalm 61, "Lead me to the rock that is higher than I," he isn't just writing a nice metaphor in a comfortable study. He is likely a terrified fugitive staring up at a towering limestone cliff face that is actively protecting him from approaching army.
He does the exact same thing in Psalm 63, writing, "My soul thirsts for you, my body longs for you, in a dry and weary land where there is no water."
It's so visceral.
It is. He takes the immediate physical threat of dehydration in the Judean desert and maps it directly onto his spiritual state. And honestly, understanding this canyon topography completely shatters our modern pastoral reading of his most famous work, Psalm 23.
Yes. Let's unpack this, because I usually hear, "He leads me beside still waters," and immediately conjure up a painting of a rolling green meadow in the English countryside with a gentle little brook.
Which is how most of us picture it.
But an English meadow doesn't require saving. When you realize David wrote this out of his experience hiding in a brutal, baking desert canyon, the translation shifts entirely. The notes point out that the Hebrew is much closer to "waters that make me still."
Exactly. The focus is on the physiological effect of the water, not the placidity of the stream.
Right.
Because for a fugitive exhausted by the heat, running for his life across jagged limestone, finding a hidden spring in a wadi isn't just some quaint afternoon break. It is a desperate rescue.
The water physically drops his core temperature.
It drops his temperature, slows his racing heart, and restores his life. The geographical context turns what we think of as a pleasant poem into a raw testimony of survival.
That blueprint of using physical isolation for protection eventually evolved, didn't it? Centuries later, people weren't just fleeing murderous kings, they were fleeing corrupt systems.
Yes, moving into the intertestamental period, around the 2nd century BC.
The geopolitical landscape had drastically changed. The influence of Greek and Roman wealth, the whole process of Hellenization, had thoroughly corrupted the Jerusalem temple.
And the mechanics of that corruption were entirely financial. The ruling Greek overlords, the Ptolemies, and later the Seleucids, essentially monetized the high priesthood.
So it wasn't a sacred lineage anymore.
Not at all. Instead of a generational lineage, the role of high priest became a political appointment sold to the highest bidder. The priest basically became a tax farmer for the empire.
Oh, that's awful.
The temple turned into an economic institution, completely divorced from its spiritual mandate.
And in response to that systemic rot, an entire community decided they couldn't fight the corruption from within the city walls.
So they left.
They left. A group calling themselves the Sons of Zadok withdrew completely, relocating to the desolate shores of the Dead Sea at Qumran.
Where the Dead Sea Scrolls were found.
Exactly. They utilized the wilderness as a massive geographic purification ritual, treating the isolation of the desert as the only way to maintain a pure covenant with God.
The daily life of the Qumran community revolved completely around this pursuit of purity. They built complex ritual baths and dedicated their lives to preserving and copying sacred texts.
Which is why those 11 caves surrounding their settlement held the scrolls.
Right. And their withdrawal set a powerful cultural precedent that carried directly into the New Testament era.
Like with John the Baptist.
Exactly. John the Baptist, who is from a priestly family himself, rejected the Jerusalem establishment to operate entirely out in this same wilderness. He was clearly influenced by the ethos of groups like Qumran.
Which sets the stage for a profound, intentional contrast involving Jesus. After his baptism, Jesus retreats into this exact same Judean wasteland for 40 days.
The sources emphasize how this event is designed to mirror both the 40 years of Israelite wandering and, even more strikingly, the very first human test in the Garden of Eden.
The psychological contrast between Adam and Jesus, often called the second Adam, is staggering when you look at the geography.
Oh, it really is, because Adam's test occurs in an environment of absolute abundance. He's in Eden, surrounded by lush vegetation, perfect climate, limitless water, and companionship.
He lacks absolutely nothing.
He lacks nothing, and yet he fails. But Jesus faces his test in an environment of absolute deprivation.
Right. He is in the barren, jagged wilderness, entirely alone and physically starving after 40 days of fasting.
Yet he passes the test by relying solely on the words of Deuteronomy, the book originally delivered to the Israelites just before they exited their own wilderness.
Okay, so what does this all mean for the specific temptations? Because when the devil tells Jesus to turn stones into bread, I used to think that was just a random magic trick.
Ah, but if we connect this to the bigger picture, the landscape makes it so clear.
Because of the limestone.
Yes. The limestone rocks scattered across the Judean desert actually look incredibly similar to small, round loaves of bread. It's a visual taunt.
Oh, wow. I never knew that.
Satan is essentially pointing to the rocks and offering a shortcut. He is tempting Jesus to manipulate his environment, to take the flashy route and instantly recreate the exact miracle Moses performed, providing manna in the desert.
It is a brilliantly calculated psychological attack.
Turn the rocks into bread, prove you are the new Moses, and bypass the suffering.
But Jesus refuses the shortcut. He refuses to break his reliance on God to satisfy his immediate physical hunger.
He embodies that Brueggemann concept perfectly,
yeah.
Having nothing but lacking nothing. He demonstrates that the sheer sufficiency of God's word is enough to sustain him, even in the most hostile environment on earth.
That is incredible. And you know, the sources don't just leave the wilderness as a place of ancient testing. The prophetic books like Isaiah, Ezekiel, and Revelation take this harsh geographical reality and push it into a visionary future.
They do. They promise a coming era where the wilderness itself experiences a complete, miraculous restoration.
Which sounds like a beautiful paradox.
Isaiah provides stunning imagery for this. He prophesies that the blinding whirlwinds of the Negev will be replaced by flowing streams in the Arava.
So the dry, desolate places will blossom into fertile fields.
And towering forests.
It
is a vision of the ancient wasteland transforming back into an Edenic state, bringing what the Hebrew calls shalom.
Shalom, meaning like peace.
Peace, yes, but deeper. It means a perfect, interwoven fabric of righteousness, social harmony, and deep agricultural fertility.
Which gives us a profound lens for our own lives, because these geographic realities map perfectly onto our psychological and spiritual experiences.
Everyone goes through it.
Let's be real. Everyone enters a wilderness season at some point, a time that feels incredibly dry, barren, and isolating. Sometimes, like the Israelites, we wander into those dry seasons because of our own stubbornness, wrestling with our own demons and the consequences of our choices.
And other times, we are driven there by external circumstances completely outside our control.
But the critical takeaway from Dr. Phillips's research is that the wilderness is never meant to be a permanent state of punishment.
No, it is a highly effective tool. Stripping away the comforts and the noise of our daily Egypt forces us to confront what we actually rely on.
So for you listening right now, the wilderness isn't just a historical footnote or a blank space on a map. When you find yourself in a season where you feel completely stripped of your normal comforts, feeling vulnerable and disoriented, recognize the space for what it is.
It is an invitation.
Exactly. It is the one place quiet enough for you to learn genuine, profound reliance.
The environment that feels like it is breaking you might actually be the exact thing required to anchor you.
I love that. And I want to leave you with a final thought to mull over based on the deep dive we've taken today. When you inevitably find yourself in your own dry, desolate season, feeling entirely drained by the elements around you, are you just going to wait around hoping for the rain to eventually come? Or are you, like that desert acacia tree, going to use the drought as an opportunity to push your roots twice as deep?